any questions before we proceed? And I have posted the office hours for the TA, and I think his office hours are Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays from 4 to 5. And his office is 311 in ITA. So you are welcome to use his office hours. I have my office hours also on Tuesdays, Mondays, and Wednesdays from 10:30 to 12. So you're also welcome. And if you cannot make it to my office hours, regular office hours, you can send me an email. Then we can find a time to meet. So that should be fine.
Two types of lectures in your website. One is for like the
intervention
of
friend-wise
only.
The basic algorithms. So as and when we enter into a new topic, then I will give you some resources for reading. So for the basic algorithms and the randomized algorithms, you know, I already posted. And then when we have other algorithms like polynomial arithmetic and so on, I will give you a reference. Even if I don't post the notes, I will give you a particular reference or something. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? So last time we were talking about the selection problem, right? So we described the worst case linear time algorithm of Blum, Floyd, Pratt, Rivers, and Tarjan, and which is basically based on the quick select algorithm, which is going to, given an element, pick up an element as a partitioning element, partition the input into two based on the partitioning element, and then figure out where the highest smallest element is, and then in the worst case, I will go and recursively do a selection in either the first part or the second part. The way the recursion is going to terminate will be when the partitioning element is the answer, at which point the recursions will terminate, then I will stop, right? So that's how the algorithm works. And that algorithm in the worst case has n square runtime, but on the average it only has linear time. We can convert it into a randomized algorithm by picking a random element as the partitioning element. And the same proof of linear time expected performance will also apply. Followed by that, we explain the deterministic algorithm, which runs in the worst case in linear time. And then followed by that, we were in the middle of discussing the Floyd and reverse randomized algorithm. And the way that algorithm works is it's going to pick a random sample of a certain size. So we finally fix the size to be n to the 2/3. So that's the size of the sample. Find the two elements, L1 and L2, from the sample. And the two elements will have a rank as follows, namely rank of L1 in the sample will be something like I times smallest divided by N minus delta, where delta we defined it in something like 5 alpha s log n. And then the rank of L2 will be I times s over n plus delta, right? The same delta, square root of 5 alpha s log n. So clearly this takes n to the 2/3 time, and this takes two selections on the sample, therefore it also takes big of n to the 2/3. So that's our runtime. So this is big O of S. And this is also big O of S. So once you have the two elements, then the plan is to drop all the elements that do not fall in between L1 and L2, and then, okay.
Just confirm, is that square root of 5 times alpha times S times log n?
Exactly. So that's how we pick the delta to be. And then, step number 3 will be, so here is my original input, then I will partition the input so that all the elements that are strictly less than L1 go to X1, and all the elements that are, say, greater than or equal to L1 and the remaining elements will go to x3. And then we said let the cardinality of x1 be equal to m1, and let the cardinality of x2 be equal to m2. But there's a little bit of a confusion. I guess I used the n1 and n2 kind of. There was a little bit of confusion. So let's make it this way. So x1 refers to all the elements strictly less than l1, and x2 refers to all the elements that are in between l1 and l2. So our hope is that the ith smallest element will indeed be in x2. Right? And also, the size of x2 will be small. That's our hope. And in fact, if I pick L1 and L2 in this manner, the lemma that we stated immediately implies that the cardinality of x2 will be big of into the 2/3 times square root of log n with a high probability. And moreover, the I smallest element indeed will be in x2 with a high probability as well. So the element that we are interested in finding, the I smallest element of x will be in between L1 and L2, and the cardinality of x2, what we call it, x2, is going to be fairly small. It's going to be big O into the 2/3 square root of 1. And this follows from the lemma. And this also with very high probability. So the step number 4, we did the partitioning, and then make sure that ith smallest element is in here, and then do a selection on that. So how do we make sure that it is in here? So that happens if n1 should be strictly less than I, and n1 plus n2 should be greater than I. So if this does not happen, then we will start out. And if this happens, then I will go and do the following, namely output select I minus n1 x2. And this will be our limit. We do a selection in the set x2, making sure that the ith smallest element is in x2, and then we will do a selection on that. So given that the size of x2 is small, this is going to take only big O of n to the 2/3 square root of log n. The only question is, how about step number 3? Steps 1, 2, and 4 take only little O of n time with a high probability, no more than n to the 2/3 times square root of log n, so which is much, much less than n. So the trivial way of doing the partitioning will cost us 2n comparisons. Now we claim that we can do it in better than those many comparisons, namely n plus minimum of I comma n minus I. So how do we do that, right? So that's a really nice trick. Any questions so far? So let's look at step number 3. So just to recall, if you look at the integer line from 1 to n, we know that the here is my L1, the rank of L1, let's put it this way. Rank of L1 in X, and this is the rank of L2 in X. And we know that I is somewhere in between here, right? So I y is somewhere here. This is with a very high probability. And we can immediately realize that our x1, the number of elements in x1 is basically this integer over here, right? That is our x1 with a high probability. And likewise, the number n2 is going to be this minus that with a very high probability. So that is what we have already seen. So roughly speaking, we can say that the set X1 is going to be having, you know, very roughly speaking, I elements. And so this is going to be a very small number of elements, like
if
little of elements.
If it's too small, then you would say that set X has I elements.
Again, yeah. So now that's why I said, roughly speaking, there are I elements, I minus some, you know, little of n elements. So let's keep that in mind. Now, here is how we are going to partition the x into two parts. Okay, so case one. Case one is when I is less than or equal to n over 2. Right, so when I is less than or equal to n over 2, so what we can do is to first compare any input element with L2, and then only if there is a need, you compare it with L1. Right? So in this case, let K be any element of X. Now I have to decide for K which set it belongs to. You know, does it belong to K X1 or does it belong to X2? That's what I have to decide, right? When I do the partitioning. So what we are saying is if I is less than or equal to n over 2, I will first compare K with L2. If K happens to be greater than L2, then I throw it out, right? On the other hand, if K happens to be less than or equal to L2, then I go ahead and compare it with L1 to see if it is either it, whether it is in X1 or in X2, right? So that's how we do the comparisons. So let K be any element of X. Check or compare K with L2 first. Compare K with L2 first. Then compare K with L1 if there is a need. And only if there is a need. So what we are saying is that if K happens to be greater than L2, we don't do any more comparisons. We will only spend one comparison if K is greater than L2, right? So that's why, roughly speaking, how many elements are in between these two? N minus I, roughly speaking. So therefore, the number of comparisons we make is going to be the following. So number of comparisons, in this case.
Don't you write?
Yeah.
Isn't it n minus the position where rank is?
You are absolutely right, yeah. So this n minus that integer. You're right.
So when we're saying roughly I, we're...
Because the size of this is very small.
Oh, I see.
Namely, this interval is very small in size.
Right.
No more than n to the 2/3 times square root of log n.
Okay.
Right, that's why we're saying roughly speaking. So... the total number of comparisons in this case. N minus I, for these elements, we only make one comparison. And for the remaining elements, we make two comparisons. Right? Plus 2 times I, plus some little O of n, which is basically n to the 2/3 square root of log. To account for this size or that size. So this can derive it in S. N plus I plus little o. Right? And that can in turn be written as n plus min of I comma n minus I plus little o. Right? Because in this case I happens to be less than or equal to n over 2, therefore it is indeed going to be the minimum of I and n. Any questions? Only because I happens to be less than or equal to n over 2, then I can say that I equals minimum of I and n minus I. Because n minus I is at least n over 2, and I is at most n over 2. Now, the other case is very symmetric. Right? When I happens to be greater than n over 2, we will first compare it with L1. And if, only if there is a need, we will compare it with it. Right, so that is the trick. So case two. So in this case, we have I being greater than n over 2. So in this case, compare P with L1 first, then compare K with L2 only for this thing. So in this case, the total number of comparisons will be. So, for all of these elements in X1, we only spend one comparison, and for all of these elements, we compare, we perform at most two comparisons each. So that can be written as I plus 2 times n minus I plus again the little o, same little o. So. And that can be written as n plus n minus I plus little o of n. And which in turn can be written as n plus minimum of I comma n minus I. Plus little o of n. Because between I and n minus I, this time n minus I will be smaller. And therefore, we have n plus n minus I, which happens to be the minimum of I and n minus I. The little o n is going to be minus I. So in summary, we can say that the total number of comparisons made in the algorithm is very close to the lower bound we stated, which is n plus minimum of I comma n minus I, but for the little o of n that we have, which is n to the 2/3 square root of 1. So therefore, the total number in the algorithm, total number of comparisons. Big O into the 2/3 square root. So this is the lower bound we stated, and we only have an additional little lower. So this is, you know, one of the best known algorithms for selection in terms of number of comparisons. And there is no deterministic algorithm which can match this one. So the best algorithm happens to be randomized. So here is another example where randomized algorithms are better than the randomized algorithms. Okay, so any questions? So far?
I don't quite get the minimum. Are you able to take the minimum in case two?
Right, because of the fact, if I look at these two, the minimum of these two happens to be n minus I, because I is greater than n over 2.
Right.
Which is the same as your n minus I.
Oh. Why don't we just write n minus I?
Because in either case, this is the answer. That's what we are trying to say.
I see.
Whether it is case 1 or case 2, the number of comparisons can be written in this form.
Got it.
So we're kind of coming up with a common expression for that.
Okay.
So this is for case 1. Also for case 2, the same thing.
Shouldn't we add this to case 2?
Only one of the two cases will occur. Right?
Okay.
So for any given input, I is going to be given to me at the very beginning. Therefore, I will either use that case 1 or case 2 in my coding. So I can have a case statement depending on the value of I. Because the value of I does not change in the algorithm, right? So it's fixed for me. Okay, so any questions? So as we can see, this if I look at this, it's no more than 1.5 times n, right? Which is strictly less than 2 times n. So, and the lower bound says, if I want to find the median, I need at least 1.5 n comparisons. And this algorithm achieves that, but for the small addendum.
The default sorting algorithm in Python is quicksort, so did they use this?
Oh, for a quicksort, you mean?
The default sorting algorithm in Python is quicksort.
Quicksort, yeah.
Did
they
use this?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So, namely, here is one possible sorting algorithm, wherein I first find the median of the n elements, use that as the partition element. So if you go ahead and write a recurrence relation, it is going to give us big of n log n. But only thing is, even if I assume that the selection, median selection takes 1.5 n, it is worse than what we can get by using the quicksort the way that, for example, Fraser and McCullough's algorithm does it. Because that we can get the constant to be exactly 1 times n log n, plus some little o of n log n, right? Like we had n log log n. Whereas if I use this one, I will get very close. Maybe something like I may get 3 times n log n. So we'll lose on the constant factor. So, but yeah, that's a good idea. So if I can find the median quickly, then I can use it to sort as well. But the median is such a nice algorithm. I have mentioned this before. Independent of the problem you're trying to solve, you know, it could be a problem like you want to find convex hull of points in a high dimensional space, or if you want to, you know, find connected components, whatever problem you have, whenever you think of a divide and conquer, you can always think about finding the median of the elements and do a partitioning based on that. So, you know, that's where the median selection is such a nice and powerful algorithm. Finds applications in many different places. Even if you want to, you know, invert a matrix, which then you can go ahead and do a divide and conquer based on some, you know, something like the median. So any other questions? So if not, of course, we have been talking about randomized algorithms, so we'll see more randomized algorithms. So the one particular idea we are going to talk a little bit about will be the so-called fingerprint. It's a very powerful technique. And used quite a bit. That's what we want to study next. So what is fingerprinting? Of course, the name tells us something. Intuitively speaking, you know, we use a fingerprint as a proxy for a human being. Like a unique identifier for a human being, right? So perhaps the fingerprinting here means something like that. So the fingerprinting approach can be used to test if two given objects are the same or not. Just like in human beings, you know, if you give me fingerprints, I'll be able to say whether these two fingerprints pertain to the same individual or two different individuals. So like that here also, I want to check if two given objects are the same. I can exhaustively check every part of the object and then see if they are the same. Perhaps that is going to take more time as opposed to just using the fingerprint, right? That's the same, you know, for human beings as well. Like, you know, I can go ahead and check the entire person, you know, like whatever image processing of the whole body and so on. But instead of doing that, we just use the fingerprint, right? So like that here. So we typically use it to check if two given objects are the same. So let's explain this with many examples. We can think of hash as a fingerprint, right? As a characterization or a representation of whatever object we need. You're right. Exactly, yes, sure. So that is something we have to take care of. So here also, something like that would happen, but we will show that that happens with a low probability. Right, so that is always the case. So let's explain with several examples. So the first example we are going to look at is the following. Example. In this case, we are given three matrices, n by n matrices. So input will be three matrices. And I want to check the following, namely output. Yes, if AB equals C, and then no other things. So I want to check if the product of A and B will be the same as C, right? So how can I solve this? Like a standard algorithm? Excellent. I just multiply A and B and then check if it is equal to C, right? Element by element. So how long will that take? N to the 3 time. Now, can we do matrix multiplication better than
it? I thought it was Streisand, if that's how it's pronounced.
I'm sorry?
Streisand problem or whatever?
Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Can we do better than N to the 3, right? So.
Strassen's
algorithm, yeah. Strassen's algorithm can do it in n to the log of 7 to the base 2, which is roughly n to the 2.81. Can you do better than that?
Not
oh, there are, okay.
I remember 3,500 conventional algorithms.
Okay, thanks for remembering. So there was an algorithm, the Strassen's algorithm came out in the late 1960s or early 70s. Whereas 1983, Coppersmith and Winograd, they came up with an algorithm using some algebraic topology ideas and so on. They showed that we can multiply in to the 2.376 time, big of n to the 2.376 time. But that algorithm is, the description of the algorithm runs into like 18 pages. It's a highly complex algorithm. So perhaps it is injurious to health to try to implement the algorithm. And it will never beat the, you know, n to the 3 algorithm in practice, unless your n is more than 10 to the 300, which is more than the number of atoms in the universe, as people have estimated. So, but it's a really nice theoretical algorithm. And quite recently, in 2011, there was an improvement over that. Victoria, she was able to prove that using exactly the same algorithm, she did a tighter analysis and showed that we can reduce the runtime to something like big of n to the 2.373. So that is the best known result for multiplying two matrices. So we can, at least in theory, we can do better than n to the 3 by using the n to the 2.373. But we want to do better than that, right? So that's where the fingerprinting is going to help us. So here's the fingerprinting algorithm. And then we will show that it is indeed going to be connected to the high power. So the idea is to pick a random vector of zeros and ones. So, forget anything. Some people, you know, when they say a vector, they mean like a column, but I'm just here assuming it's a row. So it's a row vector. So I have, and each value will be picked randomly to be either 0 or 1. I flip a two-sided coin and decide the value of each. And such that R sub I is going to be either 0 or 1. And then we are going to check the following, namely. So if A times B times R equals C times R, then output S. Else output. Right, this is a fingerprinting algorithm. So I pick a random vector and then check if A times BR equals C times R. And we want to say what the probability of correct answer is going to be. We will do that. But before that, we ask the question of what is the time complexity for this? Right? If I want to do this, how much time do I need? So herein, I have to multiply a matrix with a vector. So, and that is going to? Cost me n square time, right? So now when we say BR, I guess I can even, you know, just to be sure, I say transpose that, meaning that I take every row of, for example, in this case, I take every row of B multiply with that column, you know, and that's how I can do this product. And then this will be a vector, and then I again multiply a column vector, and I multiply A with that, then I'm going to get another column vector, and CR also is going to give me a column vector. Then I can go and check if every element will be the same. That's it. So the total time, maybe I would say here, we can do it, we can solve this in big off into the 2.373. And this can be done in n squared. Which is much better than our n to the 2.373. For all practical purposes, perhaps n to the 3 is a good algorithm. But people have done a lot of experiments to see when would the Strassen's algorithm be better than the n to the 3 algorithm, for what values of n. And then the experimental results indicate that if your n is, meaning you have n by n matrices, if your n is at least 150, then it is better to use your Strassen's algorithm. For anything less than 150, n to the 3 algorithm will be better. Right? That's an experimental result. As I said, nobody has even bothered to implement the Coppersmith and Winograd's algorithm or the improvement of that. Whereas this is very easy to do this in n square time, you know, trivial algorithm. And unfortunately, there are no better algorithms known for matrix vector multiplications. So, meaning that when you have a when you have one matrix versus another matrix being very thin, and that trick that Strassen used does not apply. So, but we can do it in n square time. Moreover, we can make the following statement, namely, the probability of an correct answer is at least 1/2. So that is the claim. Of course, we can improve the probability using repeated executions of this, which we'll see in a minute.
First, let's prove the following. So, lemma: probability of an incorrect answer is less than or equal to. So how do you prove this? So let D be equal to AB minus C.
Wait, in worst case, if it happens to be exactly a quarter, you don't
get an equal to an equal? We can, as I said, we can boost this probability by repeated executions of this. That we will see in a minute. So let's first complete this part of it. Mm-hmm. The task of improving the probability is not a big deal, right? For example, if I repeat this alpha log n times, what is the probability that I fail in each and every one of them? And that is no more than e to the minus alpha. So that we can do. In which case, of course, the runtime is going to increase by a factor of log n. So n squared log n, which is still much, much less than n to the 2.373. Okay, so let's see how this proof will go through. So we want to show that we want to show the following. Probability dr equals 0, given that d is not equal to 0, is less than or equal to 1. I have a matrix D which is not equal to 0, meaning not all the elements are zeros, right? Given that, if I pick a random vector and multiply D and R, what is the probability that I get all zeros, right? And we want to show that that is no more than 1 half. So when D is not equal to 0, there has to be at least one row which has got at least one non-zero element, right? Otherwise, it will all be zeros. So let's take a look at one such row where at least there is one non-zero. So if D is not equal to 0, there exists a row D equal to, let's call that as D1 to DK 0. Of course, without loss of generality, I'm assuming that the first k elements are zeros, non-zeros. That's not a, you know, big deal. If it is not the case, then I can permute the columns so that I push all the non-zero entries to the front. And the k is at least 1, right? That we know. So if this is the case, that what you are saying is, yeah, so there has to be a row like that with, of course, this being non-zero, so I should say k is written into the 1 such that d1 is not equal to 0, d2 is not equal to 0, dk is not equal. So let's estimate the probability that the multiplication of this row and the R column R is equal to 0 or not equal to 0. So we want to show that if I multiply this row and the random column that we have picked, the product of the dot product of the two will be non-zero with at least 1/2 probability. Right? Then that will mean that this is the case. Right? Then the product will not be identically equal to 0. So probability that dr equals to 0, probability that summation d sub I r sub I run from 1 to k equals 0. So this is the same as probability
that dk equals, so what we are going to do is, so we know that d1 r1 plus d2 r2 plus dk rk equals 0. So if I take these guys to the other side, so that will be summation of di r sub I, I running from 1 to k minus 1, the minus is coming here, divided by the dk, sorry, rk. Right, so RK equals summation of DI RI, I ran from 1 to K minus 1, negative of that, divided by DK. Just a simple arithmetic, right? So we have pushed everything to the other side, except that DK RK, and then also push dk to the other side. Okay, so here we are going to estimate the probability of this as follows. Namely, assume that you are selecting the values for R1, R2, R3, one after the other, assuming a sequential computation. So you'll be flipping the coins one after the other. So you have, assume that you have already flipped coins for D1, D2, sorry, R1, R2 up to RK minus 1. So that means when you are ready to flip a coin for RK, at that point in time, everything else is known. Namely, the right-hand side is known, right? So when I'm ready to flip for RK, the right-hand side is known. Now my question is, what is the probability that the next coin I'm going to flip will have a value equal to that value, the right-hand side? So notice that my coin flip is going to be either a 0 or a 1. And the right-hand side could either be a 0 or a 1, or it could be some real number, right? We do not know. So if the right-hand side is a real number, then the probability is 0. And otherwise, it could, what is the probability that it is equal to 0 will be 1 half, no more than 1 half, because it could be a 0, it could be a 1, it could be something else, right? So even if I assume that even if it neglect the possibility of having a real number from out of the remaining two, it is either going to be a 0 or a 1. Therefore, the probability it equals 0 is going to be no more than 1 half. Right? So that's how we infer. So maybe I'll make, this is known as the principle of deferred decisions. Namely, in your algorithm, if you are making many coin flips, so when you are making the next coin flip, at that point in time, all the other coin flips are already known. They're all known, they're all fixed. So therefore, then you can ask the question, what is the probability my next coin flip will give me such and such result? So you can ask that question, right? So that's what we are doing. So when we flip a coin for RK, any question? Okay.
Sorry, the right hand side of 1, what is 1?
the equation 1 here. By that I mean this. This one. I guess. Maybe I'll say what it is exactly.
Decisions in helping us say it's less than or equals 1/2. So we know all the prior point flips once we do RK, but how does that conclude less than or equals 1/2?
Because for simplicity, assume that this number is either a 0 or a 1.
Uh-huh.
For example, let's say it's a 0. That's what we want to know. Our coin flip is going to have only two outcomes, either 0 or 1.
Right.
So it's going to be a 0 with a probability 1/2.
Uh-huh.
And it's going to be a 1 with a probability 1/2. Okay? That's why the probability that it is equal to 0 is no more than 1/2. That's what we are saying.
I see.
And there is one small thing we also have to remember, is that the right-hand side may not even be a 0 or a 1. It could be a real number, right?
Uh-huh.
In which case, the probability will be 0.
Right.
Even if we neglect that, we still know that the probability is no more than 1/2.
Sure, okay.
So that's all we are saying. Any other questions?
But in this case, we are actually calculating the probability that there are at least one non-zero element in D. So we want D to have all zero elements, right? Because D is actually the...
Yeah, remember that we are calculating the probability conditional upon D is not equal to 0. So we know that capital D is not equal to 0. That means there is at least one row with at least one non-zero element.
So we want to show that this probability is quite small.
Again. Right. So when I multiply that row with a random column, what is the probability that I get a 0? We are saying that probability that I do not get a 0 is at least 1/2. Which means the complement probability is no more than 1/2. Right? So that's what we are saying. So, like as she was asking, 50% probability, is it a good probability? So we can improve the probability like this. Namely, we repeat this many times to boost the probability to, say, 1 minus into the minus alpha. So boosting the probability. We can do the following, namely for I equal to 1 to say alpha log n. Pick a random vector, column vector, say R. You want to call it R sub I, that is fine. So if A times B times R sub I is not equal to C times R sub I, then if they are not equal, then that means 1. So that indeed they are not the same thing. You know, put no and put. And then if I do all of them, and then if on every one they are the same, then we will go ahead and log them. So in some sense, we say that this algorithm has one-sided error. One-sided error because if indeed AB equals C, then whatever R I may pick, I will never report no, right? Because A times BR will always be equal to CR. Only when AB is not equal to C, there is a small probability that I might give an incorrect answer by saying that indeed they are the same, because my random chances could have been such that I see equality. So now in this case, what is the probability of failure or an incorrect answer? So probability of an incorrect answer. Is going to be less than or equal to 1/2 to the alpha log n, which is equal to n to the minus. Right, so the probability is boosted to of a correct answer is at least 1 minus n to the minus alpha, or probability of an incorrect answer is no more than n to the minus alpha. But the runtime has increased a little. So runtime is big of n square log n, which may not be a bad deal because log n is much, much smaller than any polynomial in n. So it will beat any of the matrix multiplication algorithms. Any questions? So let's take a look at another example. So this time we are given as input three polynomials. So f of x, g of x, h of x. And these are all degree n polynomials. And we are supposed to output s. If f of x times g of x equals h of x, and no otherwise. Okay, so here also we would be able to use fingerprinting. Now, what is the best way to solve this? Again, the same thing, right? I multiply the two polynomials, f and g, and then check if it is equal to h of x.
Wait, if h is the same degree as f and g, then can that always be a problem?
Oh yeah, you're right. I can say h is, you know, degree 2 n polynomial. Let's put it this way. Degree n polynomials. And h of x, degree 2 n.
Multiply, so the
degree
should be
n
squared.
Degree is 2 n, right? So when I multiply two polynomials of degree, say d1 and d2, the degree of the product will be d1 plus d2. Now, a question is, how fast can we do this? And first of all, what do we mean by multiplying two polynomials? That's a good question, right? So that would also require us to specify how the inputs are supplied to us. How am I going to be given a polynomial, right? So for example, a degree n polynomial has how many coefficients? So it has got
An maximum of
n plus 1 coefficients, right? Because there could be a constant to that term. So by this we mean the following, namely, I will give you the n plus 1 coefficients of the polynomial f of x. I will also give you the n plus 1 coefficients of the polynomial g of x. Likewise, for h of x, I will give you all the 2n plus 2 coefficients. And then you are supposed to check if these two polynomials are the same, right? Because a polynomial can also be equivalently represented in another domain. Of course, we will discuss it later when we talk about polynomial arithmetic. But here we mean the coefficients of the polynomials, right? So now, how fast can I multiply two polynomials, say of degree n each? N square, we can do it, right? Like the paper and pencil. So if you give me two polynomials, that's what we do. You know, we just multiply every term with every other term, and then that will give me the n square. Can we do better than that? We'll address it later, but I just want to know if anybody has seen this. So it turns out we can multiply two degree n polynomials in big of n log n time using discrete Fourier transforms. So we'll discuss it later.
What?
A discrete Fourier transforms. Has anyone seen that before?
Yeah. Is it for sampling from the continuous signal to make a discrete signal, transforming it to the frequency space?
Excellent, yeah. So we'll do that. We can do that in n log n time. You have seen it before? You have not. Okay. So what, have you seen the n log n for multiplying two polynomials?
I didn't see the random analysis. I just know what the...
Okay, yeah, that's a good thing. So we will discuss that later, you know, when we discuss polynomial arithmetic. So, okay.
But for any polynomial, couldn't it be represented by the product of x minus its roots, and then multiplying the two, and just
You're right. So that is known as the value form of a polynomial, as opposed to coefficients form of a polynomial. So you're right. So we'll discuss that at length when we talk about the polynomial. But we can multiply two polynomials in n log n time. Therefore, this can be solved in n log n time. So that is a fact. Okay, so that is good. But of course, then we have to, if we want to use fingerprinting, we have to do something better. And of course, you know, we cannot perhaps do better than linear time. And of course, the fingerprinting is going to run in linear time. And moreover, the answer is going to be correct with high probability. Let S be a subset of the field on the field on which the polynomial is defined, right? Meaning that the coefficients of the polynomial come from a field. Typically, you know, our field will be the real line, right? But we are here talking about a subset of the field, and we will see what should be the size of the subset when we do the analysis. Okay, so we are going to identify a subset of the field S, and then we are going to pick one of the elements of S randomly. Pick an element R of S randomly. Then can anyone guess the rest of the algorithm? Okay, so yeah, you are almost there. I think what you're trying to say is check if f of r times g of r equals h of r, right? That's kind of the test. So if f of r multiplied by g of r equals h of r, then output S, else output so that is the output. Now how long will this take? to do. I'm sorry. Big of n, right? So what will be the reason for that? So if I give you a polynomial and one number and ask you to evaluate the polynomial at that point, how long will that take?
That's a linear time,
right? So one can use a trivial algorithm, you know, I compute all the powers of R first, and then you multiply the corresponding coefficients and add them up. That's a trivial algorithm. Of course, there is also the so-called Horner's rule, which can be used to reduce the number of multiplications, but still it is a linear time. The asymptotic complexity we cannot reduce, but we can reduce the number of multiplications using the Horner's rule. But in any case, it's a linear time. So the idea then would be, I calculate f of r, then I calculate g of r, I calculate h of r. Right? Now they're all scalars, they're all numbers. Then I can multiply these two numbers and check if it equals that. In other words, we are not multiplying polynomials, we are multiplying scalars after evaluating the polynomials at the point r, right? So that's why the whole thing can be done in linear time. I have to do three polynomial evaluations and then I check this together. So the time will be big. Now, what is the probability of an incorrect answer? So that is obvious. So, claim is probability of an incorrect answer is less than or equal to 2n divided by the size of s. Okay, so let's define a polynomial like this. So we have used f, g, h, all this is u of x. Let u of x be equal to f of x, g of x, minus h of x. So of course u of x is a degree 2n polynomial. So I have a degree 2n polynomial, and there is a basic theorem from linear algebra which says that a degree 2n polynomial can have at most how many zeros? It can have at most 2n zeros, right? A degree d polynomial can have at most d zeros. Right? For example, if you have, you know, a degree 2 polynomial, ax squared plus bx plus c equal to 0, then there are two possible zeros for the polynomial, right? Which is given by minus b plus r minus square root of b squared minus 4ac divided by 2a. And that's a formula we learned in high school. So in general, if I have a degree d polynomial, there are at most 2n distinct zeros. Right, that is one fact. So u of x has 2n distinct zeros. So that means if I pick a random number from, random element from S, there are two possibilities, namely, the number I pick could be one of the zeros of the polynomial, in which case I will get a zero. If it is not one of the zeros of the polynomial, then I will get a non-zero if the polynomial u is non-zero. Right? If u is not zero, then I will get only zero, u of r to be zero, if the random element I pick happens to be one of the zeros of the polynomial.
By zeros, are you meaning
the solution? By zeros, we mean like if I have a polynomial f of x, by zeros of the polynomial, we mean what are the solutions to the equation f of x equals 0, right? So that's what I was referring to, the ax squared plus bx plus c equal to 0. So where the polynomial is the ax squared plus bx plus c, the zeros of that polynomial will be, you know, we know what the zeros are.
How do we know this is 2n degree? Because I know we're multiplying f and g.
Right.
But
f is of degree n and g is of degree n. Therefore, the product will be of degree 2n.
Right, but you're also subtracting h of x.
Yeah. So that means the degree is at most 2n. The leading terms might disappear, we don't know. Or it may be there. So in which case, we know the degree is at most 2n.
Oh, sorry, got it.
So, right, so that means if u of x is not equal to 0. So if u of x is not equal to 0, then u of r will be equal to 0. If and only if r is one of the zeros of this polynomial u of x. Right, so if p of x is not equal to 0, then p of r equals 0 if and only r is one of the zeros of the polynomial u of x. So that's the observation that we made. Then we are ready to answer the question, what is the probability of an incorrect answer? So there are s elements, or cardinality of s elements to choose from. And what is the probability that the one I pick happens to be one of those 2n elements that I do not want to touch? So that's clearly 2n divided by s, right? So that is how it is. So this implies that. Probability that u of r equals 0 given u of x is not equal to 0 is less than or equal to 1. So now we can say if the cardinality of S happens to be, say, greater than or equal to 2 times n to the alpha plus 1 for the form, then the above probability is less than or equal to 1. So in other words, here, if I pick my S appropriately, then I only have to do it once, right? And be sure that my answer is good with a high probability. Any questions?
So, how this probability is being less than 2?
Is that slash mark actually a given, or?
I'm sorry?
Is that slash mark meant to be a given or a divided?
Oh, this one?
Yeah.
What we are trying to show here is that the claim is probability of an incorrect answer is no more than that, right? When will my answer be?
That symbol in between the 0 and the 2x.
Oh, this is given, yeah.
Okay.
Given.
Conditional.
Conditional, yeah. Conditional on ux is not equal to 0. Any other questions?
How is the 2n over size of S?
Because I have my set S, right? And then there are only 2n zeros in here. So if I pick one of these elements, then I'm in trouble. So what is the probability that I am in trouble? So out of these many elements, there are 2n elements that will give me incorrect answer. So that is true.
And then how do we say the cardinality of S has to be greater than 2n to the alpha?
They're like a back calculation, right? I want this to be no more than n to the minus alpha. And from where I calculated S.
Don't want that to be more
backwards, right? For example, I want 2n divided by s has to be less than or equal to n to the minus alpha. Then I take s to the other side, s has to be greater than or equal to, I bring this to this side, that is going to be n to the alpha.
I see that. Thank you.
Okay, so any other questions? Okay, so let's look at another example. So this will be an extension of the polynomial. Now, we have talked about a polynomial with one variable, namely x. So this time we are going to talk about a multivariate polynomial on many variables, say n variables. And we want to check if this polynomial is identically equal to 0. I want to say yes if the polynomial is identically equal to 0, which means that whatever values I substitute, I get a 0, right? Then we say it is identically equal to 0. Otherwise, we want to say it is non. It is no, right? The answer is no. Now, how will I check if a given polynomial is identically equal to 0? Am I going to substitute every possible value and check if it is 0? That is stupid algorithm. It may never terminate. Probably, I may want to rewrite this polynomial in a specific form. For example, I may want to rewrite as, you know, for example, a sum of terms, a term being, for example, you know, x1 square, x2 to the 3, x3, x4 to the 5. So if I can express it like that, then I can look at the coefficient of each of the terms. If the coefficients are all zeros, then I infer that it is 0. But depending on how the polynomial is applied to you, this might take at least an exponential time, because you may have to multiply, you know, different polynomials to get the coefficients of each term, check it if the coefficient is zero or not, right?
Does it relate in any way with the satisfiability problem?
In fact, yeah, that's a good question. So one might be able to reduce the satisfiability to this problem, which will show that this is, you know, NP complete. It all depends on how the input is applied to us, right? For example, we may assume that the input is given to us in a certain form, which will immediately make it NP complete. So, that is true. Now, herein, we want to use fingerprinting. So, as usual, we will like to use the fingerprinting. So, how do we use fingerprinting in this case? So, a couple of definitions. The degree of a term is the sum of all the exponents of the variables. As an example, you know, the degree of x1 square, x3 to the 4, x5, x7, 3 is equal to. So 3 plus 1, 4, plus 4, 8, plus 2, 10. So if I look at a term, there are many variables in the term, each one having a certain exponent. We just add up all the exponents. That's what we mean by that. Degree of a term. Now we can also define the degree of the polynomial to be the maximum degree of any term in the polynomial. That's what we define. Some people also may call it a total degree, but we can just call it as degree of the polynomial. Degree of a multi-degree. Its terms. Oh yeah, that's what the reopener is going to look like. So we will. I'm sorry. Oh yeah, sure. Yeah, let's stop here and then we'll continue on Monday. Okay. The degree of the maximum degree of this. Oh yeah, sure. We can do a, for example, if you. Let's say I have a x1 square, x2 plus x3 to the 2, x2, x1 to the 4 plus x3 to the 1, x4 to the 5.
I didn't quite hear you.
Four. Then the degree will be
yes.
So the degree of this term is 3, and the degree of this is 7, and this is 6, and that is 4. Then we will say it is 7. Okay. So any other questions? No, I have not posted assignment. That's a reminder for me to post them.
So in the polynomial example, are we just considering the integer roots? Because if S is a
not necessarily.
But because if S is a set of real numbers, I mean, it's a subset of F, right? So that probability will be 0, right?
Oh, yeah. That
we
mean, right.
We are giving the correct answer all the time, but it takes forever to find the roots.
Sure, yeah. That is even better for us, because if my S does not have the zeros of the polynomial, then the probability of finding them in my subset is even less.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, that one was just an example for, yeah.
Okay, so I have a question, several questions. So for this part, where does this come from? Minus one.
Total number of devices.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Because of the, remember we did, oh, this is for one, the first time.
Yeah, the first time.
So we did, what we did was for case one. Yeah. So we had something like I, and this x1, and I is less than or equal to n. So in this case, we said let's first compare it with the L2, and then only compare it with L1 if there is an E. So for all of these elements, we only perform one comparison because they all happen to be greater than L2. L2 only for all of these elements. Because all of them happen to be greater than L2, therefore we will immediately put them into X2. And there is no need for comparing it with L1. One comparison for all of them. And the number of such elements happens to be n minus I. Plus little of them.
But we just need to compare A
list
only with
L2.
Why do we need to compare
I list
to
I? Oh, so here is my input A1 to A. For each one of them, I have to decide whether it goes to X1 or X2. In fact, this is X3, this is X2.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to make that decision. So let's say I take this element, compare it with L2. If K happens to be greater than L2, I immediately put it into X3. I don't have to do anything else from that. On the other hand, if K2, say, it falls in between these two, then I will first compare it to the L2. I realize it is less than or equal to L2. Then there is a question of, is it strictly less than L2 or is it in between these two? That I decide by comparing with L1. So that's why for this element, for any element that either belongs to here or belongs to here, we end up performing two comparisons. Right.
Wait, but if it belongs to there, can't you just compare it to L1?
Our policy says first compare it with L2.
Okay.
And then only if there is any incompatibility.
I see.
That's our policy.
Okay.
And we do that when I is less than or equal to n over 2. When I is greater than n over 2, we do the opposite thing. So we first compare it with this guy, only if there is a need. The only reason is that if I do it this way, in either case, the number of comparisons is going to be no more than n plus minimum of I comma. So that's the only reason.
So why don't we do the binary search if we want to partition this element?
You know, the binary search, there are only two elements to do binary search in this case.
Yeah.
So either I compare it either with this one or that one. So we are then considering two different cases and explicitly saying, you know, which one we should compare first. So to our advantage, we want to minimize the number of comparisons. Because if we always compare it with, you know, say this element, then we are going to do more comparisons. For example, when I happens to be in this case, when I is less than or equal to n over 2, we will lose because we will end up doing more comparisons than what we do.
So, the y is n minus I, should it be n minus L2?
The L2 happens to be very close to I, right, because the number of elements here is only n, like n to the 2 pairs. So yeah, you're right. I can say that n to you can even add n to the two terms to that.
So this goes to little all of
n. Oh, you're right.
Okay.
That's why we are kind of being into this sloppy. So we spend one for these guys, two for the remaining guys. I plus the same. But in any case, this is going to be very invisible. So that's what it is.
I mean, it depends on your value of n, right?
Remember, the n to the 2 thirds is always less than n, much, much smaller than n.
Right.
And even the square root of log n is much, much smaller than any polynomial.
And their products has to be very much smaller.
Right. So when n tends to infinity, this is going to be much, much smaller than n.
Okay.
That's the category you see.
Isn't it, why do you, isn't it just n minus n to 2/3 log n, where you minus an I again?
I'm just subtracting these guys, assuming that we know that this is exactly n minus I.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm subtracting this.
Oh, I see.
So I'm just charging one for them. For the remaining elements, I'm charging two.
Okay.
So they're being very conservative. Good job.
I see.
Because that follows from the lemma.
Is that an over S?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. I just substituted S to be n to the 2 thirds. So what we showed was like n to the square root of s, square root of log n, plus a multiply by some constant, something like square root of 5 plus square root of log n. And this is a constant. And then you know, when we choose s to be n to the 2 thirds, this will be n to the 1 third. So then that's going to give me the n to the 2 thirds. N over square root of s.
It has to be at least n over 2 and greater than n over 2, therefore we can take the minimum. Can you explain that a little?
Right. So when I is less than or equal to n over 2, this is the number of comparisons we do.
Okay.
Right. And that happens to be n plus I plus little of n. And we said that this can be rewritten as n plus minimum of I comma n minus I.
this guy can be written as minimum of I. Sorry. Only because I is less than n. Okay. So since I is less than equal to n over 2, n minus I is going to be greater than or equal to n over 2. And this is less than or equal to n over 2, therefore the minimum of the 2 is I.
Wouldn't n minus I be strictly greater than n over 2?
Yeah. So that means that when I take the minimum of the 2, then I will come up.
I see. Got it, thank you.
Sorry, sir. What is the issue middle of O of n?
The middle of n is basically this kind of thing.
Got it. I mean, this algorithm is kind of recursion. I mean,
no recursion.
But here is just you discuss something like that, but you name this one. Then you perform the normal big selection?
No, we can use any selection. For example, BFBRT will be fine.
Oh, because you mean this interval is small enough.
Yes,
so
small. Okay. Even if the constant is, you know, 3 or 4 or 28,
okay.
it's still a little over there.
Oh, got it.
Excuse me. I just wanted to stop you from talking.
And for this one, so there's at most the 2n, 2n plus 1 terms in this.
Oh yeah, 2n zeros for the plane.
But what if this calculation cancels the highest degree?
That is fine. Still, as long as the polynomial is non-zero, right? You're right. If this could happen so that, for instance, my f of x could be, say, x squared plus 2x, my g of x could be x squared minus x or something, and my h of x could be x to the 4 plus x to the 3 or something. Then when we calculate, you know, f of x, g of x, minus h of x, so we'll have, this is going to disappear.
Yeah.
Then I'll be left with, you know, this will be the highest degree.
Yeah.
That does not matter. As long as the f of x, g of x, minus h of x is not equal to 0, that's the case we have. So we're not saying that is the same degree as 2n, but it can have a degree less.
So what does this distinct zeros mean?
Distinct zero means that, for example, you know, if I have x squared minus 2x plus 1, this is my polynomial, then this is equal to x minus 1 the whole square. It has got two zeros, but both of them are the same. They coincide.
Oh, okay.
That's why I said it. If I look at the distinct ones, there are at most 2 and
So this is this a theory from?
Theory from Lindell.
Okay. I see. All right. Thank you.
And then just last question. Sure.
And
plus I plus little. Isn't it just I plus little O of n?
Oh, you're right. Yeah. In this case, when I is less than equal to n over 2.
Then why is there an extra n term?
Because there is a n minus I here plus 2i. N minus I plus 2i, that would give you the n plus I. And the I we are rewriting as this.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Oh,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. For the first example,
matrix, yeah.
The flip the form one, and
sure.
The smaller one. I do understand that.
Sure. So what we are doing, you know, we have the D1, D2, Dk. The rest of them is CLs. And then we multiply that with R1, R2, up to Rn. And then they're all picked randomly. So when we multiply these two, then the product is going to be the summation of dr, right? So you want to know what is the probability that this is equal to 0. So that probability is nothing but probability that, as we have, rk equals minus summation dr So what we are saying is, after all, in our sequential computing, we will first flip R1, right? Flip a coin for R1, and flip a coin for R2, and so on. And then, when we come to a stage where I have already decided up to RK minus 1, right? At this point, I already know what these values are. And maybe this is the 1, this maybe is 0, this maybe is 0. So, at that point in time, we are asking, okay, what is the probability that my RK, the next flip I'm going to make, will give me this value? If my next coin flip is going to give me this value, that means everything is going to be 0. Meaning the product of the two. So that's what we say by, okay, I already flipped coins for up to here. My product will be equal to 0 if the next coin flip I make is like this. If my next coin flip gives me this value, then the product of these two will be equal to 0. So that's what we are saying. So instead of worrying about what are the possible values for all the k of them at the same time, let's make it much simpler by saying that, after all, we are going to flip the coins sequentially. So when I have flipped up to k minus 1, I know what these guys are. I will have a 0 for the product if the next coin flip I make is like this. So if this happens, then I'm going to have an incorrect answer. Then we are saying, okay, what is the probability of this happening? And that is no more than 1. Because now we are only arguing with respect to one particular flip instead of all the flips. Because that makes the analysis much simpler.
You said it could be 1, 0, or a real number. By a real number, you mean not 1 or not 0.
Not, it could be, you know, 1.2 or minus 3.2. Or even a negative number is not good. Even a negative integer is not good. Because even if it is minus 5, my flip is going to either give me only a 0 or a 1. Probability equals minus 5 is going to be definitely 0.
Right.
So, still confused about it, but I have another thinking. So, is it correct to say